This is World Affairs Monthly, and I have Mr. Jamie Shea on the line. He is great to talk to you, Jamie. He's worked at a senior level of NATO at NATO headquarters in Brussels, Belgium, for almost full 40 years. He's worked basically in the office of Secretary General, and like I said, for full 4 decades. He's been a spokesman of NATO for quite a long time, back in the 90s, from 1993 to 2000. He's been a speechwriter for NATO. And of course, I really don't know, but NATO probably has some sort of informal think tank. In fact, I don't know for a fact, but Jamie surely did have some role in that think tank operation there, NATO headquarters. So anyway, I wanted to also say that, since NATO, Jamie's not very famous, he's not a household name. I'm going to just give everybody some biographical information. He has a Bachelor of Arts degree from Sussex University in England. That's near Brighton. That's 1977. He did a PhD at Oxford University, Lincoln College in 1981. Of course, we're both Cold War guys, Cold War boys. I think he's born in 1953. I've been born in 1958. So we were both young men. He's a bit older than me when the Cold War went south and the wall went down. Look, Jamie, it's great to talk to you. I'm a little perturbed because I'm using Skype, but no, it's okay. I'm going to start the interview this way. I suspect that we have two basic forces operating here. The first one is that, in a way, it's very difficult to win a war, prevail and conquer your enemy and, vanquish them in the, certainly in the past 30, 40 years, but almost maybe in the past 100 years. And so what typically happens is that you'll have to kill a lot of civilians. And this happened in World War II, for example. The United States, I'm not blaming the United States, and I'm not casting any blame on anybody, but, we ended up firebombing Japanese cities, Tokyo, killing hundreds of thousands of, civilians. And we did the same in Germany. And that maybe, that wasn't critical, but it clearly helped us prevail. So we won the war, right? Now, today, we have a situation where you can't really guarantee that you're going to win. And, it's going to be very difficult. And the thing is, I'm not at my computer. I had it all set up, so I'm kind of flustered here. But the second thing I wanted to mention is that Samuel Pizar, a lawyer, a friend of mine for, 30 years, he's not a household name either. Actually, he's the stepfather of Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State. And I happened to meet him in 1984, maybe 83 or something like that, in Paris, France. I was working as a journalist, young guy, and I happened to meet him. Somebody told me to go give him a call. And the reason he wanted to meet me, apparently, Pizar, is because he was sort of thinking like you and I, Jamie, about the world. And he wanted to know what was going on. He was a lawyer. He was born in Bialystok, Poland. So he's Ashkenazi Jew. And he wrote a book called Les Armes in French, and I think you speak French, Les Armes de la Paix. Maybe you've even heard of this guy, but he's on.
Yeah, Thomas, I certainly have. He's a famous name for me, so you're on.
Yeah, great. Okay, so he and I were talking. I go over to his house first time, and we met each other. And he says, "Hey, Tom, really good to meet you. And I'm amazed by, meeting you. I'm really privileged to meet you." And, he's flattering me. And I said, "Well, fine, it's really cool." And he says, "Well, I'm the architect of détente." And I said, "Really?" I said, "Hey, I believe it." And he said, he explained that Nixon and Kissinger took his idea and implemented it and didn't give him credit. And I said, that makes sense. So we talked about that. And he said, "Look, it doesn't really make sense for us to to have this big buildup with the Soviet Union. You know, this is in the 80s. You know, you were there in NATO headquarters. You know, we were the Reagan administration was going after them. Okay, fine. It worked out fine. You know, they went south, bankrupt, everything. But the fact is, maybe it really wasn't necessary. And Pizarro, all he is basically advocating is a detente, you know, where you do business. And I thought it was really fascinating. And he and I were good friends for a long time. He was probably Mossad, probably. But the fact is, we don't necessarily need to go to war these days. And I'm thinking that if the Russians and the Chinese are interested in a, you know, a situation where they can kind of have their own centers of power, you know, a multipolar world, call it that. And the United States is going to be a center of power too. So we can probably coexist pretty well with each other. And since you and I are Cold War guys, you know, probably we're reluctant to just do away with NATO, but maybe I'm going to propose that NATO maybe is obsolete, or we can reconfigure it. And we can solve this problem very quickly. Everybody would be happy. It might be a little freaky at first, but I'm supposing that, you know, that we're going to basically sign on to this Pizarro program. And it's just kind of odd that Blinken is promoting the war program, you know, when his stepfather, and I called his mother, by the way, I talked to her and I told her, I don't think your husband and I, you know, I don't approve, and I don't think your husband would approve either. So anyway, that's how I want to start, Jamie. And I'm going to give you the platform and you give me your critical thinking, but that's what I'm going to say. I think we need to dissolve NATO at war, you know, better yet, reconfigure it. And allay the concerns of the Russians. And by the way, I'm going to go through the list of NATO members just for the audience. It's quite astonishing. You know, there's 30 NATO members now, and I think it started with 12 or 11. So here are the NATO members: Albania, Bulgaria, Belgium, Croatia, Canada, Denmark, France, Greece, Czech Republic, Estonia, Latvia, Norway, Poland, Slovenia, Portugal, Germany, Hungary, Lithuania, Iceland, Italy, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Montenegro, North Macedonia, Romania, Slovakia, Spain, Turkey, United Kingdom, United States. So, the other thing I want to mention, of course, is that George Kennan did warn that if we built out NATO, you know, the way we have, it would cause a serious problem. And of course, he was right. He was ignored. So anyway, I'm finished. Great to talk to you, Jamie.
Well, Thomas, great to talk to you as well, and thanks for inviting me on this evening. Look, you raised a lot of points, so I'm going to try to sort of unpack them one by one. You'll either be convinced by my arguments or you won't. You'll certainly follow up. I know you only too well. So let me just start out.
If you can get a little closer to the mic, it would be great.
Okay, well, let me just start out, and then we'll obviously follow up with the conversation afterwards. Well, first of all, you mentioned, of course, that the wars are about targeting civilians and breaking the will of the civilian population. Well, certainly, I would say that that's what Russia is trying to do to the Ukrainians at the moment. The Russians expanded the war way beyond simply trying to subjugate the Ukrainian military. They have forcibly created a humanitarian crisis that's driven 7 million Ukrainian refugees out of the country. Some may go back, some may never go back, but many of them are in Poland, 1.8 million. Living in temporary accommodation. I'm in Warsaw this evening from where I speak to you. And you've seen that Russia, particularly over the winter, is trying to create an even worse humanitarian crisis by striking at residential buildings deliberately. These are not, you know, targeting errors. One error may be, but not when you're firing thousands of weapons at residential infrastructure targets, attacking the electricity grid, turning your lights out, you know, disrupting water, food supplies, just trying to make life as miserable as possible for as many millions of Ukrainians as Putin can. So it's very much a kind of, you know, full-out war against the Ukrainian society, the Ukrainian population, to try to wipe Ukraine as an independent state off the map. But it's certainly not simply about taking a little bit more territory in the Donbass on the other side of the Russian border, or defeating Ukrainian military. On the other side, I would argue, Thomas, genuinely, and I believe this, that it's not the same. The Ukrainian army is attacking the Russian army, and it's only really attacking the Russian army on Ukrainian territory. Yes, okay, there have been a few sort of fairly daring do sort of special forces operations that Ukrainians have sort of carried out at their bases inside Russia, but limited operations. But again, military targets. I don't have any evidence so far that Ukrainian forces have struck any civilian targets deliberately, trying to kill civilians, or have done this either in the Russian-occupied areas or in Ukraine itself. So from the Western point of view, with all of the weapons that, you know, NATO countries and others, not just NATO countries, many others, 54 countries in all, have been supplying to Ukraine, the idea is to try to sort of break the ability of the Russian army to sustain this operation inside Ukraine by making it obviously accept high losses so that Putin clearly finds it harder and harder and harder to justify to the Russian population why this is a good cause in their interest, and eventually to oblige Putin to retreat limping from the battlefield so that we can have a proper peace. So I don't see what the West and Ukraine are doing in terms of resisting the Russian aggression as being fully the same or fully symmetrical with the Russian way of warfare, where you've seen, you know, the deliberate causing of environmental damage, military operations around nuclear power plants. I mean, what could be more dangerous than that? Kidnapping. Thousands of Ukrainian children, taking them back to Russia and then putting them up for adoption, child theft on a major scale, stealing Ukrainian grain and as I said, taking apart its sort of infrastructure. So I still believe, you know, whatever the reality of war, and it's a nasty business, Thomas, I grant you that, but I still think there is a fundamental difference in values and execution between what I would call the Western way of warfare for limited military objectives, you know, not trying to defeat Russia, not trying to humiliate Russia or humble Russia, but simply raising the cost of this aggression in a way that forces Russia to retreat, and the way that Putin is carrying it out in an attempt to actually sort of liquidate a state. You know, we haven't had anything like this since Saddam Hussein back in 1990 at the outset of the Gulf War. You remember that went into Kuwait and declared that Kuwait no longer existed as a country, that it was now henceforth going to be the 19th province of Iraq. And the United States and George H.W. Bush, to your eternal credit on that occasion, decided that, no, we're not going to allow this to happen. This is not the way that we want, you know, the post-war security order to evolve. You know, this is the kind of might equals right that we want to get away from, you know, after the Soviet Union collapsed. And I see Ukraine as a similar kind of test for the democracies. You know, if we allow Russia, which is meant to be a responsible member of the UN Security Council, upholding the UN Charter, and the UN Charter explicitly forbids wars of aggression, to sort of break virtually every international treaty and every international norm. For example, the Ukrainians have registered 71,000 individual cases of Russian war crimes in their country in just 1 year. And 26 Russians have already been prosecuted. It's not a big number, but it's a beginning in Ukrainian courts to face some kind of accountability for that. So, you know, if you allow a country like Russia to sort of rip up every single, you know, international humanitarian convention, arms control treaties, treaties to protect nuclear power stations and all of the rest, where are we going to be in terms of how other autocracies may feel that it's worth taking risks to achieve the same kind of result? So that would be the first point. Now, okay. I don't want to do all the talking. You obviously want to come back at me.
No, go ahead, please.
But on the second point, Samuel Pisa, yes, I didn't know him personally like you did, but he was one of the gurus of the 19th 90s, when the Cold War was coming to an end. I read his book, En Français, so I'm familiar with that. And it may be a pity that he didn't get all of the credit for Détente, but of course, as you know, Thomas, it's a cruel law of life that failure is an orphan, but everybody claims the credit and says, it was me who thought of it when it comes to a success. So that's always going to be the case, unfortunately. But I would argue, you know, you argue about NATO. Well, you know, the NATO of the 1990s was not the same as the NATO of the Cold War. I was there. I lived it. Yeah. So I know what I'm talking about, at least not on everything, but I know what I'm talking about on this particular topic. You know, we had a massive disarmament. In NATO at the end of the Cold War. The Americans pulled out 300,000 troops almost from Europe. They pulled out all of their tanks. They reduced their nuclear weapons from 7,000 to just over 100 as a residual NATO deterrent. All categories of nuclear weapons, particularly intermediate range weapons, were stripped out entirely Ronald Reagan and Gorbachev agreed. You remember, Thomas, the great arms treaty called INF, Intermediate Nuclear Forces, in 1987. It's true that, you know, NATO did eventually enlarge, but NATO didn't enlarge because it sort of went out into Eastern Europe as a kind of recruiting sergeant. You know, we want to get bigger, come and join us. It enlarged because there were a number of countries in Central and Eastern Europe with tragic histories. I mean, I am in one today, Poland, partitioned three times in the 18th century, you know, part of the Tsarist Empire for much of the 19th century. Again, devastated in the First World War, independence snuffed out until 1918 when Poland emerged. And then again, back in 1939 and 1940, Baltic states, similar kind of, you know, in existence, not in existence, again, history. So these states, you know, given these histories, wanted to have the same kind of security, the same assurance regarding their future, the same ability to develop their democracies and their economies that, you know, the traditional NATO states and the European Union states had enjoyed. So they wanted to go west rather than NATO wanted to go east.
Of course,
it was only after they persistently knocked on NATO's door and said, hey, you know, we want to be part of this Western family of nations. We want to have a seat at the table. You know, we want to sort of buck the trend of our history. We don't want our geography to be our destiny any longer. We don't want to be, you know, the pawn being squeezed between great powers the whole time. It was only after they insistently knocked at NATO's door that NATO enlarged. But there was a time, Thomas, in the 90s where basically you had a NATO which was far more political than it was military. The peace dividend was being reaped. Everybody was cutting their defense budgets to historically incredibly low levels. And if you look at, you know, I'm a historian, and you look at what European powers were spending on defense throughout much of the 20th century, it was around sort of 6-8% of GDP as the norm. And by the 90s, you know, for the first time in their history, big, big European military powers, France, Germany, the UK, were spending just over 1%. Of their GDPs on defense. The proportion of defense as, you know, as public spending vis-a-vis education, the National Health Service and everything has gone to an extraordinarily low level. In my country, the UK, by the end of the Cold War, we were spending five times on the National Health Service as we were spending on the defense budget. And it's a good thing. I don't mean this in a critical way. Of course not. Right. It was a fantastic sort of sign of progress. And when NATO took in, after 1999, countries like Poland and at the time the Czech Republic and Hungary and so on, the Baltic states and other countries came in later, we didn't move any military forces whatsoever onto their territories.
Yeah.
We gave a pledge to Russia that provided things in Europe remain peaceful. No NATO troops would be stationed in Poland. No NATO nuclear weapons would be put on their territories. There would be no military infrastructure. In fact, Thomas, I can tell you that I used to have Polish ministers in my office back at NATO complaining bitterly to me that they felt that they weren't getting any protection from NATO at all. Right. Because, you know, they weren't getting the American sort of GIs on their territory, the American bases that they had seen in Germany during the Cold War in West Germany. One famous Polish foreign minister, who is still quite politically active, he's in the European Parliament now, Sikorski, Radek Sikorski, he was in my office one day saying, Jamie, we've been in NATO for 15 years, and what have we got to show for it? Training center in Bydgoszcz. And we also had a very good relationship with Russia, an excellent relationship with Russia. We set up a NATO-Russia Permanent Joint Council in the late 1990s. Russia was a member of NATO's Partnership for Peace. And we later on set up, after 2002, a NATO-Russia Council. There was a Russian ambassador to NATO. There was a Russian military representation to NATO. And you may think that this is surreal, but do you remember that ship that was sunk, the Moskva, by presumably by the Ukrainians? Remember in the Black Sea after Russia invaded Ukraine? I was on it. I was on that ship. A couple of years back, together with the NATO Secretary General, when the Russians invited us to have a sea day together with NATO ships, and we visited each other's ships. I recall, you know, going down to the Balkans when the wars in the Balkans finished, and I would fly into Pristina. The Russian commander of the airfield under the NATO peacekeeping operation in Kosovo would greet me. We would go and have a cup of tea. He would then offer me his car to be driven from the airfield down into Pristina, because the Russians, both in Bosnia and in Kosovo, were part of the NATO peacekeeping mission. They contributed to it. You know, in Afghanistan, we had enormous cooperation from the Russians, because they didn't like the Taliban any more than we did. So the point I'm trying to stress here is that there, you know, the NATO, which you say should be disbanded because you may think it's an instrument of some kind of military confrontation with Russia,
there wasn't much.
Is the NATO which Russia has created. It's not NATO that has created the NATO that is now in a military confrontation with Russia. It's Putin who has created that NATO. For example, Finland and Sweden. They were, until February the 24th last year, the day of Putin's invasion of Ukraine, these two countries were non-aligned. EU members, absolutely no talk of joining NATO. They were happy to be non-aligned. It was part of their historical tradition. Only about 20%, 25% of the population supported NATO membership. There was no consensus politically. Now they are on the cusp of joining NATO, particularly if Turkey will ratify their membership. But that's another story. Is it NATO that said join? No, it's Putin. You know, the Finnish president, Niinistö, has been pretty clear, saying, you know, Mr. Putin, you are responsible for the fact that we are now joining NATO, because you have created a threat to us, which is new, and which forces us to look for American protection. Let's take Ukraine. Before 2014, when Russia first went into Ukraine, annexed Crimea, Ukraine was a neutral country. I know it very well, Thomas. I visited the lot. Again, only about 20% of the Ukrainian population wanted to join NATO. Today, it's 85%, according to the latest poll I saw, that want to join NATO. Why is this? Is it because, you know, NATO has suddenly sort of, you know, gone in with some PR campaign to convince the Ukrainians to join? No. In fact, the Ukrainians know that many NATO countries have been rather hesitant about Ukrainian membership in the past. But after 2014, Russian aggression, the Ukrainians changed their constitution. They opened the door to joining NATO. Public support went up, and we are where we are today. So to some degree, you know, the fact that NATO has had to turn away from peacekeeping in Afghanistan, the fact that NATO has had to sort of turn away from, you know, dealing with sort of cyber defense or terrorism or energy security, all of the other sort of big issues that we were dealing with a few years ago, the fact that NATO has had to go back to collective defense is not because NATO woke up one morning and said, hey guys, you know, we need a new mission. Wouldn't it be nice to go back to collective defense? But because this has been imposed on us by the fact that Russia has not been willing to accept this kind of sort of cooperation with the West, which the West was offering Russia after the Cold War. It said, no, we don't like that. We want to go back to basically being a great power. A great power means a sphere of influence. We don't like the 21st century. We prefer to live in the 19th century. We're more familiar with that. No, you know, and we're going to sort of, you know, pay the price in doing that. But you know, what I'm saying is NATO is reactive when it comes to
Russia.
I don't mean that in a bad sense, but, you know, NATO has never done anything to provoke Russia, which justifies what Russia is now doing to Ukraine and possibly to do with NATO. It's wholly the fact that, you know, NATO has been forced to remilitarize, regrettably, on the back of the kind of refusal, you know, to sort of go along with the post-war settlement in Europe that came about after the collapse of the Soviet Union. I mean, you wouldn't find many people in NATO who would say, like Putin did, that the collapse of the Soviet Union is the greatest tragedy of the 20th century, right? Most of us would think it's probably one of the best things that happened in the 20th century. But anyway, I rest my case on that. But if you got rid of NATO tomorrow, particularly with Russia in its current expansionist frame of mind, you would have to sort of wonder how far into Europe the Russian army would try to advance. And, you know, nobody is willing to take that gamble and give up an insurance policy, which has worked pretty well, particularly for the Europeans over the last 70 years.
Okay. Now, sure, I understand. NATO is not NATO was, in fact, I think he was a spokeswoman of the Kremlin. I can't remember her name exactly. Maybe you know who I'm talking about. She actually said there was no difference between the European Union and NATO. You know, it's kind of one and the same. So NATO was sort of like a deal where, you know, you're not really going to get that much security, but you're going to join the European Union.
Well, certainly, you know, a lot of countries in Europe did see that, you know, NATO was the first step on the way to the EU because, frankly, it's an easier organization to join.
Exactly.
You know, if you want to join the European Union, Thomas, as you well know, you have to go through this sort of ringer, which takes years of 35 different chapters, you know, dealing with all aspects of the economy, banking, you know, education, administration, foreign policy, you know, whereas, of course, NATO doesn't have the same sort of very intrusive sort of process of application. So it's easier. In that respect, and Finland, but you know, you've also had countries like Finland and Sweden, which have been happy to stay out of NATO, just like Ireland today, while still being members of the European Union. But what I think has happened in Eastern Europe is because of the perception of a threat from Russia, the number of countries wanting to be in both organizations now, like Finland and Sweden, or Ukraine, which has applied both to join the EU and to NATO, is increasing. It's really only in Western Europe that you have a situation where a country like Ireland, which I know very well, of course, a name like Shea, how could that not be the case? You know, which is comfortably sandwiched between Great Britain and the United States, and therefore enjoys the security, you know, of being comfortably in the middle of the, you know, the US and Canada and Great Britain, you know, has the ability to keep to neutrality in a traditional sense, not seek to join NATO. But you're seeing the further you go into Eastern Europe at the moment, the more you're getting an overlap between NATO and EU membership.
All right. Now, we, that is Americans, were funding this Ukrainian insurgency. You know, we removed the you there?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. We removed the fellow, I don't know, I can't remember his name. You know, he was a pro-Russian guy, and we got our pro-Western guy in there, right? And so, you know, and then we were funding, as far as I understand, Dick Black here in the United States, you can look him up, Richard Black. I did an interview with him. He's saying that we were funding the attacks on the Donbass, you know. And so, well, so, okay. The fact is, we are now at war. We're doing this proxy war, you know, and everybody's going to wonder, can we win? And I'm just going to say, you're going to make your argument, but I'm going to say we're not going to be able to win. And the main reason is this. In 2014, it was probably 2014, 2015, the Ukrainian state which is very poor per capita GDP, very, very low, maybe 4,000 or 5,000. Maybe it's much higher than that because there's a black economy. But officially, it's $4,000, $5,000 GDP per capita. And they went belly up. They could not pay their external debt service costs, and they asked for a bailout. And the IMF agreed. And I'm pretty sure it's close to $15 billion a month they're getting just to keep their lights on, just for them to function. And the IMF managing director, this Bulgarian woman, she recently admitted what I had been pressuring her to admit. And that is this year, just to keep the lights on, just for the Ukrainian people to function, you know, as a normal place, we're going to have to shell out at least probably, well, she was saying, $40 to $48 billion just this year. So they're on the dole, and that's a big deal for the United States and for the Western countries. So I'm just going to say that if this goes on too long, and it may do that, we're going to be in a position where we're going to have to bail because we can't afford it.
Yeah, well, no, that's right. In the sense that I know those arguments are getting traction in the United States.
Yeah, that's right.
11. Yeah, no, it's true. And in some quarters in Europe as well. It's not easy to maintain support for being involved in conflicts indefinitely. You know, wars are not popular, and I fully understand that. I wouldn't expect them to be. And I know that there are some Republican congressmen, 11 of them so far, who have sort of come up with a kind of Ukraine fatigue sort of committee and whatever, and are threatening, you know, not to vote the credits and the rest. But, you know, I would sort of, you know, put it this way. Yeah. It's true that the United States has made a fantastic effort, both in terms of the military support, the weapons it supplied. Biden, I think, has been an incredibly good president in leadership, in rallying, you know, NATO into action. And that has, of course, been the reason why the Ukrainians have been able to put up the heroic resistance they've been able to put up and give the Russians a bloody nose. But the crisis has had a good side as well, in the sense that, you know, we've learned that we were far too dependent past on Russian gas and Russian oil. We could be the blackmailed because of that, you know, particularly when Russia tried to exert the blackmail early on and turn the taps off in terms of, you know, not sending any gas any longer to the Baltic states or to Poland and even later to Germany. And if you look at the situation now, in just a year, for example, Italy or Germany have reduced from 55% to 10%. Their dependency on Russian gas. They've diversified. You know, we've taken a look at supply chains and everything, looking at China as well, of course, in this respect. So we can't be subject to those kind of dependencies and that kind of blackmail in the future. So that's the right thing. Secondly, the United States has spent a lot of money, it's true, but so has Europe. You know, I'm the first person, Thomas, to really applaud, you know, the great sort of support that comes from the United States, particularly in terms of upholding the cause of democracy and organizing the rest of the world and providing the leadership. But others are doing the same. You know, the European Union just last week voted 18 billion euros for Ukrainian budgetary support. The International Monetary Fund, you're right, the lady is called Kristalina Georgieva, Bulgarian managing director. They've been meeting in India with the G7 today, as I speak to you, coming up with another $10 billion support package to get Ukrainians through. The European Union, for example, has been training 30,000 Ukrainian soldiers. Obviously on the equipment and you know, individual European countries, I don't need to give you the full statistics, but all of them, you know, have spent a lot of money on this effort. By the way, billions too, which is something you have not had to do in the United States in terms of, you know, housing and accommodating and putting kids into school, of the 7 million Ukrainian refugees who have come into Europe. Mm-hmm. The fact that, you know, all of them have been looked after without some major sort of, you know, migrant crisis like we had in 2015 with people coming in from, you know, Afghanistan or Iraq and so on, you know, I think sort of does speak well to the way the Europeans have handled this. And so is it expensive? Absolutely. But what's the alternative? Are we right. simply going to allow the Russians to ride roughshod over Ukraine? Because we just don't, you know, want to make an effort, or because anything for a quiet life, or please don't disturb me, or we only do things if people pay us to do them. And we would then, of course, have a major Russian force on our borders. We would have to go back to very, very high defense budgets in the trillions of dollars. For years to come, because we would have to face down that kind of Russian threat. China would be emboldened, which means that the United States would then have to spend trillions of dollars of helping Japan or South Korea or Taiwan in being able to deter that kind of threat. So, you know, I would argue that a short-term injection of cash, which allows us to sort of, you know, basically show Russia that force doesn't work and to go back to some kind of rules-based order and reopen sort of international trade, but with less naivety when it comes to those dependencies, particularly vis-a-vis countries that can blackmail us, you know, a short-term effort with, you know, economic growth returning and everything afterwards is going to be massively better than, you know, just sort of, you know, thinking let's not spend the dollar today and being in front, confronted with a very, very dangerous world where we have to spend far more dollars tomorrow. But the United States does have a point when it says, look, but the burden has to be shared. You know, we can't just do it all by ourselves. The Europeans have got to get into the game. I think the Europeans are starting to realize this. I mean, you know, at the beginning of the conflict, the United States was thinking of supplying sophisticated weapons. And you heard Europeans saying, no, no tanks, you know, no artillery. We don't want to provoke Putin. We don't want to escalate. But over the last couple of months, I think you've seen the Europeans really step up to the plate more. You know, the Germans have really turned the situation around. They're increasing their defense budget to 2% of GDP. They're spending an extra 100 billion euros on their armed forces. You know, they're now organizing the Leopard tanks and so on. The French are sending a lot more now than they were at the beginning and so on. So I think, you know, if you're the U.S. Congress looking out, you can say, look, okay, the Europeans may have been a bit slow at the beginning, but they're now really sort of picking up that part of the burden. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if you look at what, you know, the United States spends on defense every year, $800 billion dollars now on defense, you know, defense budget, and out of an $800 billion defense budget a year, are you willing to, you know, to devote $20 billion of that? In terms of your stocks, weapons in the Ukraine to maintain the international liberal order. So are you willing to take $20 billion of your $780 billion for the sake of international peace? I mean, if you're spending $800 billion on defense and you're not getting any international peace and far less, is that really, you know, the best use of your funds in terms of national security? So I would argue that it sounds a lot. But in terms of the overall American economy, you know, which is a $14 trillion a year economy, what the U.S. is spending, although it's a big commitment, is perfectly sustainable in terms of the benefits that the United States will have at the end. So, you know, that's the way I would put it. You know, nobody likes spending money, but, you know, you can be – remember, I think you say in the United States – a penny, what's it called? A penny wise, a pound foolish, or a dollar foolish? We say that in the United Kingdom anyway, a penny wise, a pound foolish. I think this is a case of that.
Yeah, I'm just simply saying, you know, I'm 64, born in 1958. I'm just saying to myself, look, I don't think this war is going to end in anything positive for anybody. I think it's going to bankrupt everybody. And I think, you know, that's my best guess. And now, granted, you know, I don't think we can really wisely characterize the Russians as the bad guys. I think, you know, for example, I'll tell you a story about Pizarro. I'm in his office one year. I don't get, you know, who knows, 1984, something like that. And he's describing, he's in Bialystok. He's a teenager, right? And he says that the Russians army coming from the east and the German army coming from the west, they were both in town and they were both shooting Jews in the street, both of them. So I'm simply saying that I think if you have that perspective where you're kind of sandwiched between, you know, you're going to probably say, well, how can this kind of conflict go on much longer? You know, it's going to go on, it's going to go on. And at some point, it's got to stop. Right. And I'm just suggesting that the United States got involved in the West, in the Eastern Hemisphere in World War II, World War I, starting World War I. In fact, it's not well known, but in before World War I, the United States was a net debtor nation, meaning that it borrowed more money than it was sending out to the world. And at the end of World War I, it became a net creditor nation because the Europeans were fighting wars, fought a war, and we funded it. And so we became actually very influential and wealthy because of the European war. Then the Second World War came, and we were not surprised at all, I suppose, that it was a gargantuan net creditor status at the conclusion of that war. So war is going to bankrupt you, and if you don't kind of see that coming, you're going to finish yourself off. So my argument would be that I don't think anything's going to come out of this that's going to, you know, impress anybody. So I think we should basically give up our idea that the Russians are bad guys. Okay. They had their communism stuff. That was really crazy. I went there in 1987. Total lunacy. But that's in the past. I think we need to accept, you know, for example, Richard Nixon, I'll finish in a second, Jamie. Richard Nixon, pretty smart guy. He said, well, we don't want these Chinese to be our enemies. So he opened up relations with China. And I think it's turned out pretty well. I mean, it's pretty scary because we're competing with China now, 1.4 billion people. But the fact is, we were enemies with China. We had no relations with China. And now we're okay with China. And I think we should be okay with Russia. So that's my argument.
Well, yeah, look, let me again return to the end of the Cold War. We in the West didn't see the Cold War as a humiliation from Russia in terms of winners and losers. You know, John F. Kennedy said a rising tide lifts all boats. And at the time, we hoped that, you know, the collapse of communism would make all of us happier in terms of the peace dividend, in terms of more freedom, more security for everybody, the ability to have a completely different relationship with an emerging democratic Russia than we've been able to have with the old totalitarian communist Soviet Union and so on. We reached out to Russia. As I've told you, Thomas, we invited Russia into NATO by establishing a NATO-Russia Council. I tell you, Thomas, I was at a meeting personally with Putin in 2004 in his first term in the presidency, where he actually asked what Russia needed to do to join NATO.
Right.
And he didn't mean that as a joke. I'm not saying that the Russians would have done it, and maybe they would not have wanted a classical type of NATO membership or whatever, but you know, seriously, they didn't look at that time on NATO as an adversary. We did join peacekeeping together, as I mentioned. We opened up. In fact, I was there opening it with the NATO Secretary General George Robertson, a big mission in Moscow, you know, so that we could maintain friendly relations. We really believed that, you know, cooperation with Russia would make life easier for everybody. And it did, in the sense that, you know, Russian help was very good in Afghanistan, because the Russians were also worried about, you know, Islamist extremism affecting their own territory. We had good cooperation in the Balkans. We had some difficult times. We had some difficult debates as well. We cooperated in the Mediterranean in counter-terrorist maritime operations as well. So we generally hoped, you know, that on the back of dealing with issues like piracy or global climate change or Iranian nuclear proliferation, you know, these sort of threats to all mankind, as it were, that we would be able to build this kind of new relationship. And we certainly, you know, did not exclude the Russians from anything. They were also had a relationship with the EU. The G7 became the G8, you remember, so that Russia could participate in all of the meetings. You know, Russia had a dense network of ties to the Western democracies. But when you say, you know, the Russians aren't the bad guys, I have to differ. I'm not demonizing demonizing the Russians, far right. from it, particularly as somebody who spent a lot of time, in Moscow and working and dealing with Russian diplomats and trying to find, avenues of cooperation. But the yeah. fact of the matter is, we've had over the last 20 years, the Russians stationing their troops in Georgia, invading Georgia in 2008 and detaching two provinces, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, from Georgia. They have refused to pull their forces out of Moldova, which is a neutral country, but the Russians won't leave. They invaded Ukraine for the first time in 2014 by annexing Crimea and then starting a big conflict, which killed thousands of people, by the way, before mm-hmm. Putin invaded for the second time last February, the 24th. They've carried out chemical weapons attacks in the United Kingdom, using polonium 135, mm-hmm. using Novichok, killing British citizens, totally innocent British citizens in that process. They've mm-hmm. carried out assassinations. They've completely bombarded Syria with submarines. Go to Aleppo these days, you'll see what I mean. They've assisted one of the bloodiest regimes we've seen in modern times, which is that of Assad in Syria, who has dealt savagely with his domestic population, with the Russian providing military aid and the like. Look at the record. Look at the record in the last couple of years. They've increasingly turned their back on cooperation, and they've increasingly sort of started to develop a narrative that it's all a fault of the West. They're the hapless victim. Putin has developed, has closed the country off. Opposition leaders like Alexei Navalny have been poisoned, and put in prison. Yeah. You now have a situation, Thomas, that, hundreds of thousands of young Russian men are fleeing the country to escape the draft, or because simply economically they see no future for themselves in the kind of Soviet economy which Putin is recreating, let alone the totalitarian society. The free media have been closed down, journalists have been assassinated, and the like. No, I don't want to demonize the Russians, quite the contrary. Yeah. I was one of these naive optimists who generally hoped that, at the end of the Cold War, the relationship could be fundamentally rebooted. If you look at European history, it's true, Thomas. World War II. Could we have defeated Nazi Germany without the Soviet Union? Big question. Napoleon, it took a coalition that involved the Tsar Nicholas I to bring down Napoleon at the time. The Russians have often been, big factors in creating a European security system. But today, the problem we have is that they no longer want to be partners like they were previously in creating and maintaining that European security system. They basically want to wreck it and they want to undermine it. Do we sort of have to give up hope that in a post-Putin period we couldn't go back to some kind of cooperation with them based on a more pragmatic and more, realistic Russian government? Russia would have its interests, but not see its interest in trying to systematically undermine all of its neighbor countries. I would hope so. But, if you listen to Putin's speech at the football stadium yesterday or his State of the Union speech the other day, he created a narrative that everybody's out to do Russia in. They're not responsible for anything. They're the hapless victims. They're surrounded by Nazis and so on. And when you get somebody who's clearly completely, given up reality and has created his own sort of private mental universe where 2 + 2 = 5 and night is day and black is white and so on, it's not easy to see how you can create some kind of new basis of understanding with that kind of person. I'd like to believe that Russia is not the bad guy, Thomas, but unfortunately, the facts, to my mind, prove otherwise.
The French and the Germans were at each other's throats and killing each other, slaughtering each other, and now they're allies, right? So, I don't know. Japanese and Americans are now apparently the relations between the two nations are excellent. And we were slaughtering each other, 70 or 80 years ago. So
yes, but the fundamental difference is that after that conflict came to an end, Japan transformed itself from a militarist society, venerating the emperors of God, with a very submissive population, into a modern active democracy. And Germany transformed itself from a fascist totalitarian country, where a famous Nazi leader called Reinhard Heydrich said the only private citizen in Germany is a person who is asleep. In other words, in your waking day, you have no individuality any longer. You're simply a kind of, you know, functionary of the Nazi state. Yeah, after the Second World War, Germany changed permanently into a democracy. You know, the idea that, you know, today Germany could lapse back into fascism or Japan could lapse back into militarism, it's very far-fetched. But unfortunately, you know, that didn't happen in Russia at the end of the Cold War. The Soviet Union collapsed. Russia went through a short-lived period of democracy. It was a flawed democracy. Mainly all democracies are flawed, really. Mm. It was not a perfect democracy, but a period of openness and freedom, but then lapsed back into a Soviet kind of totalitarianism. In fact, it's worse than the Soviet Union, because at least Soviet totalitarianism had a Politburo. You know, Khrushchev was fired by his associates. You know, there was some kind of collective leadership. There was some kind of a debate. You know, the intelligence services could tell the reality about the situation in the Soviet Union to the political leadership. I mean, the Soviet Union produced a Gorbachev. Can you imagine Putin's Russia today producing a Gorbachev? It's very, very fun. Yeah. So, I take your point, and I'm the first person to salute, you know, Franco-German friendship. In fact, just a couple of days ago, we celebrated in Paris the anniversary of the 1963 Franco-German Elysee Treaty, which marked that sort of, you know, friendship and burying of the hatchet. But it takes a permanent transformation towards democracy. And unfortunately, it's the reverse that's now happening inside Russia.
Yeah, you know, I would argue, and I hear you, and I think a lot of what you say is correct. I'm not going to dispute it. But today I should mention this email that I sent to Henry Kissinger. And I'm going to read it to you. I sent it on December 16th, 2022. And the reason I sent it is because I read a article that he wrote and published in the British Spectator. And he was arguing, I'll just summarize. He was saying, hey, we need to settle with the Russians because this is going to be a world war. It's going to escalate. So I said, hey, you know, that doesn't sound right to me. I was fearing that at first. But so here's my email. And I copied the Pentagon Joint Chiefs of Staff. I copied the Russian Embassy in Washington. I copied the White House and the Council on Foreign Relations in New York City. Hi, Mr. Kissinger. I will read it more carefully, your article, but I got the gist of your argument. My reactions. Your premise that we must be seeking negotiated settlement in Ukraine, otherwise it will devolve to a world war, the Third World War. I disagree. There will not be a Third World War. This conflict will not degenerate into a world war. Number one, this is a different world. We have the internet, computers, satellites, very inexpensive but powerful weaponry, drones, javelins, stingers, etc., blah, 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 going everywhere in the world. Number two, the U.S. retreated from Afghanistan because it could no longer afford, the sum $250 to $300 million a day it had been spending there on average for the past 20 years, during that 20-year period. I understand the USA is supporting Ukraine because it is not self-sufficient, and indeed, it is bankrupt. It's a bankrupt state. The cost is around $500 million a day, $15 billion a month. The U.S. is heading to default. Its debt service is too high as a ratio of income. Conclusion. Russian will pretty easily win this, and Ukraine will be fully occupied by Russian armed forces. The USA will have to quit supporting Ukraine after about 4 to 5 years for financial reasons. Within weeks of the financial support ending, Ukraine will be overrun and easily destroyed. And then I say, Mr. Putin is advisors. I haven't talked to him, but I figure they think I'm right. I do not expect any Russian negotiation unless NATO is, you know, completely refigured or dissolved. I could be wrong about these statements, but I doubt it. Hey, thanks so much. Talk to you later.
Yeah. Well, that's quite a reply, Thomas, you put there. I think, you know, there are many premises behind.
So do you think I'm wrong?
No, I do. You keep coming back all the time, so we can't afford it, sort of argument. I argue we can.
We can, okay.
Yes, we can. I mean, the United States has been providing weapons to Ukraine from its stocks. The numbers of weapons that U.S. has been providing to Ukraine have been very modest. You know, we're talking about 30 Abrams tanks when Ukraine has got hundreds of them. You know, two or three, one Patriot missile battery. U.S. has got scores of them. You know, five, six, seven HIMARS things. I mean, I salute all of this. I really do. But the idea that the United States is kind of stripping its military dry, you know, to the bone, and would be incapable of doing anything else in the rest of the world because everything's being spent on Ukraine, I think this is wrong. You know, no American aircraft have been given to Ukraine yet, and so on. The numbers are very, very modest. It is sustainable. You know, yes, would you prefer to spend it on schools and highways? Of course you would. But you know, in terms of the overall American GDP, American unemployment is an all-time historical low. The U.S., we can do it, at least for the time that it is required to counter this form of aggression. As I've said, if we don't, we'll be spending a lot more dealing with it
later on. Okay.
Afterwards, yeah. Now, that's the first thing. The second premise of all of this is the Ukrainians can't win. Well, yes, they can. You know, we've seen over the last years that the Russian colossus is not a colossus. They've got feet of clay. You know, their command and control has been miserable. They've had to use convicts and mercenaries who have, the convicts have died in vast numbers to push forward. They have been defeated three times around Kiev, around Kharkiv, and around Kherson by the Ukrainians. And the Ukrainians have been able to push the Russians back without any NATO troops. You know, it's not a proxy war, because a proxy war is when NATO would have its own troops on Ukrainian territory, you know, fighting alongside the Ukrainians like the Americans were doing in Vietnam back in the 1960s. This is not the case. You know, we're giving Ukrainians the weapons, but they are doing the fighting themselves. Every Russian killed so far has been killed by a Ukrainian. None have been killed by Americans or Brits or anybody else. So David has been able to take on Goliath, even with quite modest military support from the West. So what would the Ukrainians be able to do if we gave them significant military support? You know, 300 tanks rather than the 48 tanks that are currently going to be sent to them. You know, 600 armored personnel carriers, which is what they want, potentially a number of aircraft. You know, if they can do all of this with a very, very modest and very slow delivery, little ammunition being supplied from the West, what would they not be able to do with a much greater all-out effort? So, you know, we're not here talking about defeating Russia. We're not talking about invading Russia. This is not Operation Barbarossa in 1941. In fact, the Americans are very explicit when they give these weapons to Ukraine, Thomas, that they're never to be used by the Ukrainians to attack Russia itself, or Joe Biden, the administration, is going to pull the plug. It's simply making the Russians pay a military price, which puts pressure domestically on Putin to withdraw his forces from Ukraine. Russia has sustained almost no, maybe a couple of oil refineries have been hit by drones and so on, but almost no physical damage out of all of this. You know, unlike for the Ukrainians, life in Russia, apart from the economic sanctions and so on, and all of these hundreds of thousands of men who are leaving the country, goes along more or less, as normal. So, and you know, Putin knows that the last thing that NATO is going to do, or the United States, is get directly involved in the conflict itself. But as long as the Ukrainians are willing to fight and show the capacity to fight successfully, my belief, it may not be yours, but my belief is that we have a moral duty, if we believe in democracy, to help them. And of course, the UN Charter, under Article 51, does provide for the right of self-defense. It's not a Ukrainian insurgency. An insurgency is when a bunch of guys try to get rid of a legitimate government. And the Ukrainians are not trying to get rid of their own government. Quite the reverse. President Zelensky has got a lot of support. So I wouldn't personally be able to use that term insurgency. I think it's a national resistance against foreign occupation, which is perfectly legitimate as well. So, Thomas, you may be right in the sense that if this conflict, let me just finish on this and then you come back in. But if in 4 years' time we've got a stalemate and the Russians are not getting anywhere, the Ukrainians are not getting anywhere, we've got a kind of First World War sort of trench warfare stalemate system. Diplomatically, of course, people are going to probably have to take a fresh look at it all, right?
That's right.
As long as, you know, the Ukrainians have got the momentum behind them, Putin is having to sort of sacrifice vast numbers of troops. The Pentagon estimates that maybe up to 200,000 Russian soldiers have been killed in 1 year. It's highly destructive. You know, how long can Putin sort of hide that reality from his own population or expect support in the war to be continued if the Russians are paying that kind of price? You know, vast numbers of their armor have been destroyed. And it's calculated by the British military intelligence, Thomas, that the Russians have had to put about 80% of their army into this fight, in order to maintain their position. So, to my mind, the jury is not yet in on the Ukrainians can't win. It's hopeless. Force them to negotiate. They're going to go down anyway. No, I wouldn't accept that. This is too fatalistic. It's defeatism. It's too fatalistic. It suggests that we human beings have no agency in this world and we just have to sort of submit to cosmic forces over which we have no control. I reject that thesis. I think Western democracies have leverage. We have agency. Whether things go well or badly depends on what we do and what we don't do. We're not passive in this. Decisions we take will make the difference. Political will, unity, will have its reward here. And so, as long as we can have still an outcome where aggression does not go unpunished, my sense is that that's what we've got to sort of back fully. If there's a stalemate in 4 years' time, Thomas, your thesis will obviously get a lot more traction, but not today, Josephine.
You want to give it a little while.
I want to give it a little while. I'm not ready to throw in the towel yet.
Okay.
It's like a boxing game. Not ready to throw in the towel.
I hear you. I just think that I was going to talk to Leon Panetta, a friend of mine, Leon Panetta. You probably know
him. I remember him well from the Clinton administration.
Yeah.
And of course, he was Secretary of Defense as well afterwards. Yeah.
Right. His assistant asked me, what are we going to talk about? And I said, I just thought of this. You can look it up on the net. There's different ways to skin a cat. And I think that's the bottom line. Jamie, we're at 1 hour. Would you like to do a second part, in a week or two?
I'm happy to do a second part in a week or two, Thomas. But
let's finish
on a lighter note because we've discussed some pretty foreboding topics tonight, war and peace. These are not nice topics to talk about. But you mentioned Leo Panetta, and I remember him well because you remember he was chief of staff for Bill Clinton.
That's right, yeah.
And you remember Bill Clinton was a great talker. I was at a meeting in the White House. The only reason I was at the White House, of course, was I was tagging along with the NATO Secretary General, Spaniard called Javier Solana. And we had our meeting on NATO with Clinton in the White House. Clinton's very eloquent, and Leon Panetta is there as the timekeeper. That's his job as chief of staff. And then at the end of the meeting, Solana turns round to Clinton and says, "Mr. President, what's the mood in the United States at the moment?" And anyway, I don't know why, but Clinton suddenly gets behind that topic. He gets passionate. He starts talking. And Panetta, sees, "Oh my God, I've got, the Chinese foreign minister waiting to come and see the
president."
Start getting very red-faced, smoke comes out of his ears. And what his trick was? He's got his pockets full of change. Quarters and dimes. And he gets up and he starts rattling the pockets furiously. That was his it was his kind of message to say, "Mr. President, shut up."
That's pretty funny.
Clinton ignores him and carries on. "Mr. Secretary General, I can tell you, that the news there, Panetta getting more and more frustrated, jangling these coins, trying to create a crescendo noise until finally Clinton stops. So it was really one of the biggest contests of wills between a president and his chief of staff.
Panetta had a big job.
abiding memory of Liam Panetta, the Herculean task, the Herculean task of a White House chief of staff trying to keep, you know, Clinton on schedule and just stop him talking. God.
Well, that's a big job.
Anyway,
all right.
An anecdote, hopefully on a lighter note to end.
Yeah, no, we'll talk in a couple of weeks or whatever you want. I'll email you, but bottom line is, I think we're all looking to see this end, and I think burying the hatchet, maybe that's the old expression, but it's probably a smart thing to do.
Yeah. Yes. It's probably better to be a terror that ends than a never ending terror. Let me put it that way. Yes, it's got to end, but like all wars, the circumstances in which it ends.
Yeah.
You know, think of the difference between 1945 and 1919, for example. The way in which wars end determines whether you have peace or whether you're in a new war within 10 years. So I agree, it's got to end, but it's got to end in a way that provides at least some justification for all of the effort that would have gone into it in supporting Ukraine.
All right. Well, look, Jamie, thanks so much. And, I told her here, last point I'll make is I interviewed a friend of mine, Marvin Weinbaum, yesterday, and he complained that it went on too long. You know, I'm listening to him. He's talking like you. And I said, look, Marvin, there's a tension between extemporaneous commentary, which is what you're doing, and more rehearsed commentary. So, you know, it's great to get the extemporaneous one, but it can go on a long time.
Well, absolutely. And you asked very good questions, Thomas. I may have sort of disputed your thinking.
No, that's all right. But
I can't criticize you for not asking the right questions. And so,
good.
I very much indeed. And again, Thomas, thank you for the opportunity to be part of the series.
Sure. Great. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
God bless.
Bye-bye.